Welcome to Influencer Business, where influencers get help with the hard stuff. Think of us as your business Bible. We're a team of influencers and entrepreneurs dedicated to bringing professional resources and infrastructure to our community. I'm Rich Scutellari, CEO of Trove. I'm an entrepreneur focused on helping influencers run and grow their businesses with the resources and information they need. I host this podcast as well as a live webinar called Office Hours, which takes place every Wednesday. Here, I dig deeper into each weekly topic and answer all of your most pressing questions. Our weekly podcast features guests from across the professional landscape, sharing their experiences and advice and answering questions from the Trove community, which you can submit on our website at www.trovebusiness.com. Welcome back to Influencer Business. I'm your host, Rich Scutellari. Really excited to have you with us here today. We're sitting down and talking to Kaya Yuryev, who is a journalist over at CNN Business, where she focuses on the technology sector, but more specifically, big social platforms and influencers in particular. We're going to talk to her about a variety of things today, what she's excited about in 2020, what she's seen happen in 2019, where she thinks the industry is going. She's written a lot about things like Instagram removing likes. She's talked a lot about Twitter and things that are going on there. She was at VidCon recently. She's been covering TikTok. Really wonderful perspective, a 10,000 foot view of the industry from somebody who keeps her pulse on everything that's going on. So wonderful conversation with Kaya coming up. But first, before we get to that, if you haven't already, please go leave us that 5-star rating. Give us that glowing review. It's the end of the year here. We always appreciate it. Help us grow heading into 2020. Anything that you can do, we'd really appreciate. But with that out of the way, and without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Kaya to the podcast. Kaya, thanks so much for joining us today on Influencer Business.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So before we dive into kind of influencers and the industry in particular, let's start with some of the basics for folks who maybe don't know much about the world of journalism. Kind of tell us a little bit about your day-to-day, because obviously you write, but most of your time is probably not even spent in front of a computer writing. It's probably chasing down stories, talking to people, making sure you get the full picture.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I spend a lot of time just looking at social media. Mm-hmm. I'm on the phone all the time talking to sources, companies, brands, influencers. I do a lot of research. I meet a lot of people for coffees. I go to a lot of events, whether it's, you know, specific events for media or events hosted by brands. I also go to a lot of conferences. One of my favorites that I went to this year was VidCon, which is the biggest conference for video creators. And it's really fun because it's kind of like your normal industry conference, but it also brings together influencers, their fans. So there's, you know, screaming teenagers running around looking for their favorite YouTubers.
Yeah.
So that was just everywhere you look, there was a story idea. So, and then I do spend a lot of time in front of the computer writing and
Your standard stuff. So how do you approach kind of finding your next story? Is it just you're putting out all of these different feelers and then something piques your interest? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a mix. For future stories, I have kind of an ongoing list of trends and things that interest me that I have saved on my computer, topics I want to write about, or, you know, story ideas I've gotten from talking to sources or talking to experts. I also just do a ton of research and reading about the space, you know, watching YouTube videos, and ideas can come from that too. Or the comments or replies to tweets also can have surprisingly interesting insights. I also do cover a fair amount of breaking news. So a lot of times we'll do a first write on the news. And then if it's a big story, we think about, you know, what follow-ups can we do? What analysis can we do to kind of push this forward and go deeper in the story? And also I cover a lot of the changes and updates to the major platforms, social media and big tech companies, whether that's Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, you know, Google, YouTube, sometimes even LinkedIn and Twitter announcements too. So there's always a lot happening. So I think there's a ton of story ideas out there. It's just a matter of kind of honing in on, you know, what's most interesting.
Let's talk about breaking news for a second, because there is this fine balance between getting the story out there first so that you're the first source versus getting all of the as many facts as you can. How do you strike that balance?
Yeah, so our approach is always to get it right rather than getting it first, although, you know, we always want to get it first. One tactic sometimes we'll take is we will get just a few sentences up. So if it's a really big deal, you know, we'll write a few sentences, get that up, and then update it as we go along with more. But I think the facts are super, super important. And, you know, we always have two editors look at stories. So. Yeah,
it's funny because quality control is such a big issue on the journalism side, whereas on social media, everybody's saying everything. There is no filter.
Yeah.
And it's a crazy world. It's funny to think about the fact that you're covering one of those industries. And on the other side, like there's this filtering process that aggressive filtering process that takes place.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you have a checklist of things that you put together? Like when you're putting together a story, do you have a checklist of things that you think through that you need to have in order for a story to kind of go live?
I'm a big list person.
Oh,
so
okay.
I make lots of to-do lists. So I do kind of try to plan out the story and think about what kind of voices I want to include, what kind of experts, you know, what kind of different perspectives I can bring in. I think the most important thing that you want to answer is basically the basic questions of who, what, when, where, and why. That's really journalism school 101. To me, the most important thing is the why. So why is the story important? Why should the average person care? And I think if you've answered that question, then you've done your job.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And how do you measure success? You talked about you've done your job. How do you guys measure success?
For me personally, I think a story is successful if you're able to bring something new and unique to the conversation around a topic. You know, the story grabs your attention. It's engaging. It's compelling. It has a lot of different voices and perspectives. It's written in a clear and concise way. I never want to waste a reader's time with unnecessary information, but at the same time, I want to give them the background and context they need. I always kind of write with my grandma in mind. She's 82. She lives in Poland.
Shout out to grandma.
And while she does have an iPad that she can use pretty well, she's not super tech savvy or familiar with a lot of the things that I write about. So I usually kind of imagine how would I explain this to her or to someone, you know. So I try to write for both the person who has been following the topic really closely, but also for someone who maybe is reading about this for the first time and may need more background information.
That's really hard to balance because
it is.
You know,
yeah.
The person who's following is like, okay, I've read this before. Whereas the person who's just entering, because these articles are living on the internet and you never know when somebody's going to get them 5 minutes after the news broke or 2 days, 3 weeks after the news broke.
Definitely. Yeah. So it's definitely a hard balance to strike, but I think I err on the side of kind of trying to explain and give the necessary context.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I want to talk to you really briefly about being a long-form journalist in a world that seems to live 140 or 280 characters at a time, how do you think about capturing an audience's attention and having them read everything that you wrote?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because we're inundated with so much content and there's so much news out there. So I think the key is just kind of, especially in the front of the story, really grabbing the reader's attention, you know, starting with a really strong anecdote, you know, putting your best quotes at the top and hoping that, you know, it's engaging enough to.
Mm-hmm. And that has parallels to what influencers should think about doing in their own content, right? Because you got to grab somebody to make sure that they get through everything you want them to get through.
Definitely.
It's very similar.
But at the same time, you don't want to be clickbaity.
Right. Right. You got to strike that balance. So you cover a broad range of topics, but you've seemed to kind of hone in on tech, social media, and influencers is a big component of what you cover. How did that come about?
So I started at CNN as a general assignment reporter for tech. So I covered everything from new iPhones to social media companies to smart speakers and everything in between. I think my natural kind of interest is in the social media space, the culture around different platforms, how they change, how people interact with them, you know, how people make money through social media, and also the dark side of these platforms too, you know, the problems that can happen. So it kind of naturally came about where I started pitching more stories and kind of carved out a niche for myself covering these types of topics.
Interesting. So you were kind of given a broad area and you've kind of honed in over the course of the last several years on the topics that you're excited about and where you think you can pull interest. It's almost like mining. You're mining these interesting stories. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
That's awesome. And so how do you approach then? You talked a little bit about it earlier, you know, to go to conferences and whatnot. Is there a systematic way? Like, do you have a checklist? You said you're a list person. So do you have a list of things? Hey, I got it every day. I've got to get through these five things every week. I've got to hit these three things in every month. Like, how do you approach it?
I stay pretty open. Mm-hmm. I like being a generalist in some ways because you get to cover a lot of different stories. So while I kind of focus on social media, I stay flexible and open to different storylines and topics. I think a lot of it depends on, you know, what's happening at a given time. What are people talking about? What's interesting during that time? But there isn't, you know, a list of things that I, you know, have to write five influencer stories this week or
sure.
Anything like that.
Do you think at all about diversification of your stories? And like the last three I've written have been about influencers, so I got to hit big tech. Like, do you think about that at all?
I, I don't track that super closely. Mm-hmm. I think it honestly just depends on the news cycle. And I try to, you know, write about different things and different topics, but I'm not worried if the, you know, last few stories have been on a similar topic.
Sure. Or, yeah. So one of the areas you cover, obviously, is influencers and the impact they're having on the world in many different forms. Let's talk about that for a second. Who do you find yourself engaging with more in that industry? Do you find yourself talking to more influencers, more brands, more agencies?
It's a little bit of everything. I talk to influencers and creators a lot. I spend a lot of time talking to the agencies in the middle, the influencer marketing platforms. I think they have really great insight into the space and are great experts for stories on the industry because they sit kind of between brands and influencers. So they have a good idea of kind of who's thinking about what. Mm-hmm. And I do speak with brands too quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And so what trends are you seeing? Or, you know, it could be the last 3 weeks, could be the last 3 months, could be the last year. What are you seeing in the industry based on your conversations?
Yeah, I think one of the buzzwords that I hear over and over again now is authenticity. Mm-hmm. So I do see this, especially with the growth in stories, especially on Instagram. There's this big push and trend into being more real on social media and not always putting your best foot forward on the platform. Instagram has notoriously been, you know, this highly edited and curated place.
Yeah, the highlight reel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've noticed kind of influencers and just normal users in general will post stories that are a little bit less polished, more kind of behind the scenes of their life. Maybe they're not wearing makeup and they're just talking to the camera directly and mm-hmm. and just being a little bit more.
I never wear makeup in my photos.
I'm also hearing more people talk about mental health online and kind of being more open about their anxieties or, you know, depression. YouTubers especially have been more vocal about burnout and the toll it takes on them to have to churn out videos so much.
Yeah.
I think as a user or a viewer, you know, it can seem like YouTubers have, you know, the best job ever. There was a recent study that said that young people want to be YouTubers more than astronauts, which made me a little sad.
Of course, RIP NASA.
I get it.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people don't realize the production and effort and time it takes, especially if you're a mid to small size creator, you're doing a lot of this on your own. And
right.
it can be hard to budget your time. You find yourself working all the time. So I think there's been more of a conversation around that and more YouTubers taking breaks and talking to their audience and being like, this is really hurting my mental health to be churning out so much.
Yeah, it takes the same amount of time and effort to produce a video for, you know, 10,000, 100,000 people that it does 20 million people.
Definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you think about kind of the monetization opportunities that the smaller influencers have, right? It's smaller dollars per video, but it's the same amount of work, sometimes more, because they're going above and beyond. And it's really nice to see people talking about these things more openly. I mean, traditionally, you know, we haven't in the past. And it's not just mental health. It's things like miscarriages. I've seen a lot of that recently.
Yeah, a lot of fertility struggles.
A lot of fertility struggles. And it's nice because in the past, people just thought they were alone. They were going through it by themselves. And it's nice to know, hey, listen, this happens. And there are people and places you can go to get help and you know, move along on your journey in a very positive way.
Yeah, you feel a little less isolated.
And I think that's maybe a positive that's come out of the social media. You know, we often talk about how negative social media impacts our lives. But that is nice to see. Yeah. So, you know, what are some of the major shifts that you're seeing kind of the last 12 to 18 months vis-a-vis like the big social media platforms? Not necessarily maybe how people are using them, but the platforms themselves and what they're focused on.
Yeah, I think there's been a bigger focus on well-being recently and kind of making social media less toxic. You know, we see Instagram and Facebook experimenting with hiding likes. You know, Twitter is taking some steps to try to improve conversations happening. One change Twitter has recently made is the ability to hide replies to your own tweets. So if someone's responding with something off topic or spammy or, you know, harassment, you can hide that reply. And Instagram has rolled out a bunch of changes aimed at bullying too, which has been a huge problem on their platform. They have a new tool that uses AI technology to tell users when their comment could be considered offensive before it's posted. So it kind of gives them a chance to reflect and be like, oh, maybe I shouldn't post this. They said that in their early tests, it has caused people to not go through with the comment. So it's kind of all these little changes that are happening and tech companies
matter.
Hope that, you know, together, collectively, they'll make a difference.
Yeah. And does it feel a little bit like, because I think people forget that, you know, Facebook has only been around for the last 13 years, right? It's a teenager.
Yeah.
Right. And we often think of it as this mature platform and complain about it as if it's been around forever. like these platforms have lives of their own and natural evolutions. Are we seeing kind of the growing up phase of some of these platforms?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think that Mark Zuckerberg thought that Facebook would become a place for news or for commerce or, you know, for fake news. So I think these platforms have evolved in ways that I think the founders didn't expect. Same thing with Instagram. It's become, you know, an e-commerce platform. You can shop on Instagram. And just the whole influencer marketing industry kind of naturally happened on Instagram. That wasn't something, you know, Instagram created or pushed. It just was something that happened. So I think definitely these platforms are becoming, you know, in some ways a one-stop shop. I mean, you can now, you know, send payments on Facebook and order food and do all of these things.
Live your life on Facebook. Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned that you've covered is the hiding of Instagram likes. I want to dig in on that a little bit because obviously Instagram is still kind of the hot platform. TikTok is making a strong push. Snap is always waiting in the wings and doing some really interesting things. But I want to talk about that. Given all the conversations you've had, what have been kind of the key takeaways? What are people feeling in general? Can you break it up in terms of this is how the agencies feel? This is how, you know, or maybe it's just everybody in general.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a mix. I spoke with users over the summer in countries where Instagram has been testing hiding likes. So in Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, and other countries to see kind of what it's like to actually use Instagram without likes. Most of them felt pretty positively about it and said it's a step in the right direction. You know, I have, you know, users told me that, you know, there was an American living in New Zealand and she was like, I wake up in the middle of the night to post my Instagram so my friends back home see it. So it's kind of nice to alleviate some of that pressure without likes. Some people said it was a little weird at first, but then they stopped noticing it. You know, others said that they missed likes and were so used to looking for that number under a photo. But at the same time, some people, you know, appreciated the effort to kind of tackle mental health, but said, you know, this is by no means a cure-all solution. You know, there are a lot of reasons besides likes that people can feel anxious on Instagram. You know, that includes mean comments, bullying, feeling left out, you know, seeing this stream of perfectly edited photos, fabulous vacations, and then kind of feeling like your life isn't quite as good.
Right.
So taking away likes won't solve any of those issues. Plus the fact that you can still see your own likes was an issue for some users because they said, if I'm someone that cares about likes, I can still see that my photo underperformed even if other people can't see it.
Yeah, it's an interesting shift. And some of these issues with kind of creating a better place has to also start with our own approach to social media, right? Not allowing ourselves to get pulled in too deeply or having just a healthier relationship with it. And it's hard, especially when it's your job and that's how you get paid, right? To not obsess over these things. So another area that you've covered is these CGI influencers, which is fascinating. And can you tell us a little bit about that and what you found?
Yeah, the CGI influencer space is super interesting to me. I think it all kind of blew up with Lil Miquela, who is a digital avatar from a company called Brud. And she's kind of one of the biggest examples of this. She has almost 2 million followers on Instagram. And there was kind of this whole cat and mouse game where, you know, for 2 years, she didn't disclose that she was a CGI and people were kind of, you know, writing in the comments, they weren't sure. And then they kind of came out and said, you know, I'm a robot, even though robot is not quite totally the most accurate term, right, I think, for that. But
right.
There's also, you know, so to me, Lil Miquela is a good example of, you know, they built kind of a personality around her and they have a really strong Gen Z and millennial audience. Some of the avatars are so realistic. Cameron James Wilson is a UK-based photographer who has since launched a modeling agency that just has virtual models. It's called The Digitals. And his first virtual model was Shudu, and she went viral last year. And he wasn't always upfront that she was a CGI to the point where brands were reaching out to her to rep products, thinking she was human. So now he's very clear and upfront about it. And he kind of said, I wanted to put her out in the world and see if people believed she was real. And she's really realistic, especially if you're kind of mindlessly scrolling through Instagram. Shudu has been featured, you know, in magazine spreads and she, you know, models clothing on her Instagram account. So it's a super, super interesting space.
And have you talked to any stakeholders about this and how are they reacting? Brands, you know, influencers, agencies, like how are people thinking about this?
Yeah, I think a lot of from the brand perspective, I think a lot of brands want to show that they're on the cutting edge of technology and, you know, they're open to kind of experimenting with this and seeing what their audience reaction is. With a virtual model, brands can kind of specify the exact look they're after, you know, down to, you know, hairstyle, gender, race. I spoke with another firm that only has digital models and the founder was like, you know, brands don't have to worry about influencers having a bad attitude or, you know, not pulling through on a deal or, you know, getting older, or missing work. And it's kind of like this very Black Mirror-esque approach. But I think from a brand perspective, they're especially the brands that are kind of more, you know, on the cutting edge, they want to see, you know, if this is a, you know, worthwhile and interesting venture.
Right. From a personal perspective, what do you think about the long-term?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think this really blew up a lot last year, and I think I haven't seen so much, you know, there was a lot of interest last year. Shudu's Instagram page is updated and she's still, you know, being featured in magazine articles. I'm not sure about, you know, the longevity of this. I think, you know, brands will tap into an influencer because they want to reach that person's audience. The influencer has built a trust with their audience and they trust their recommendations. And I'm not sure you can get that same level of trust from a virtual.
Yeah. Cause avatar. If I comment on your photo and you're a digital avatar and you respond, how do I feel as a consumer? I don't know if I'm invested the same way. Also, what are their Instagram stories like? That would be impressive if they were also doing videos and Instagram stories.
I haven't seen so much with stories. Video is harder with CGIs because with a photo, you can trick people a little bit more, but the movement is still very, you know, robotic in the early stages. So.
Right. That's fascinating. Yeah. So what do you think we're going to see in 2020 that people aren't talking about right now? What are going to be some of the important trends, things like that in 2020?
I'm super interested to see if 2020 candidates will use influencers as part of their campaigns, you know, either as paid surrogates or, you know, there has been a little bit of coverage about this, but I'm interested to see if we'll see an influx of influencers, you know, being more vocal about politics or which candidates they support, or if they'll just stay away from that topic because maybe their followers have, you know, varying viewpoints. And I'm also interested, you know, if a campaign is paying an influencer, what the disclosures around that look like, especially on Instagram. Is it going to be, you know, paid partnership with, you know, X campaign or, you know, so I think there can be some murky territory there as well.
Yeah. I mean, all kind of legality, you know, kind of conversation aside, candidates would be smart to engage with, you know, influencers.
Definitely, especially if they're trying to reach Gen Z and millennial voters. I think that's an interesting way to try to tap into that audience.
Absolutely. Anything else you expect to see in 2020?
I'm super interested to see kind of how the no likes will play out. If Instagram actually, you know, the fact that they're testing this worldwide now, I think indicates that they're really serious about this.
Well, I also, they say testing. I mean, I think this is a response to, do you remember the horizontal feed scroll?
Yes. Like that disaster?
So I think that they put this label of testing on it just to assuage potentially the backlash and have the ability to roll it back. But I think my gut says this is going to be here for a minute.
when it came to the US, I was like, okay, this is, it's one thing to test, you know, in Australia, which is so far away from their core US market. But so I'm interested to see how that plays out. And then what happens, you know, if there is a backlash, if how that affects influencers. I've spoken with influencers and influencer marketing agencies to see if they're preparing for this in any way. It sounds like there's so many metrics that go into these deals that are important, especially depending on the campaign. So brands are already looking at beyond likes. They're looking at an influencer's audience, where they're located, how old they are, how many impressions they have. So there's so many metrics that go into it. So I think the gut reaction sometimes is like, oh my gosh, what happens to influencers when there's no likes? But I think there's so much that goes into these deals that it may not change the influencer marketing agency so much. But I am curious to see if the structure of deals and if engagement is measured in a different way. Also, if the likes aren't showing up, are people going to be less likely to like things?
That's actually what I'm more interested in. I think that you're right. The metrics on these deals have grown up in a big way. And so people are asking for, let me see how many views you got on your Insta stories, how many swipe ups, you know, those types of things. What were the reach? And so I don't necessarily think that the likes disappearing is a problem, because as you said before, influencers can get you that information. And a lot of third party agencies can plug into an influencer's you know, content platforms and figure out those numbers. But what's really interesting is, are we going to see, and this is, of course, is, you know, pure speculation simply because none of us have any insight into the algorithms. And candidly, I don't think most people who work at Instagram or Facebook actually know the algorithms themselves, because they're 300 plus levers like that they're pulling on. But are people going to be less likely to like something because they don't see a number, right? There's that kind of groupthink mentality that occurs. And then two, how does that impact the distribution of that content? Because if a like is a positive signal to the algorithm, if that goes away or that is reduced, obviously Instagram doesn't want to reduce the distribution of this content. So how are they going to change the algorithm? What's going to come into play? I think it's all going to be very fascinating.
Yeah, that's the one thing that influencers have told me. I think overall, they're pretty positive about it, because I've had influencers tell me that, you know, they'll be choosing between two photos and they'll really like the first photo better, but, you know, the water in the background looks so nice, so they go with the second photo. So I think they're excited about the potential to kind of be more creative and have some of the pressure alleviated, but they are worried about kind of, what does this mean for how my content is surfaced? You know, are people less likely to like? A big thing I've heard is that comments are going to be a big thing. And you're already seeing influencers kind of encourage people to comment and be like, comment below, and not just, you know, nice dress, but more, you know, fostering discussions and more of a community feeling.
Right.
So I think comments are going to be increasingly important too.
And as these platforms evolve, they're always going to evolve. The only thing that's going to be constant is change. And it's really fun, I think, to see who keeps up and who interjects their kind of unique take on something and has it take off and go viral. Because going viral today is very different than going viral even just a year ago or 3 years ago. And so understanding what's at play and what resonates with people in the audience and what matters, it creates this great opportunity for people who are entrepreneurial, who are willing to test and willing to try different things out. And so you can't just sit on your laurels anymore. It takes a lot of like work and effort and thought. And it's hard. Like you said, people burn out all the time.
Yeah, I think the people that adapt are going to be the ones that do well and have longevity.
Right, absolutely. So you obviously get to see this industry from an interesting vantage point. You talk to a lot of different folks, but I want to hone in on kind of the perception of influencers. So what are some of the misconceptions that people have about influencers, whether that's coming from the press, whether that's just generally what they see on the internet? What are some of the misconceptions?
I think one of the biggest ones is that it's easy. Like, oh, you take pictures for a living and travel to all these places. Like, your life is, you know, so difficult. But I think in reality, most creators, whether they're YouTubers or Instagram influencers, they really are entrepreneurs. They have done an incredible job of building a brand, often around themselves and their personality, and they've been able to monetize that. And many of them have aspirations beyond, you know, just being an influencer. They really want to build a business. You know, they have merchandise, they've designed fashion lines, they've written books, they have blogs. Some of them, you know, sell e-courses on how to build a social following. So I think a lot of them have bigger aspirations besides internet fame and are really working to build a business. You know, they have people working for them. They're figuring out how to, you know, file their taxes and invest their money.
You can head to trovebusiness.com for that.
But I think that's a common misconception, is that, oh, they just sit around and take pictures all day. And another one too, I think, is just how time consuming content creation is. I know we've talked about
this a little
bit.
Do you know how hard it is to edit videos? Oh my God.
Yeah. And, you know, influencers tell me that just for a photo, it can take, you know, 4 to 6 hours or more to, you know, stage the photo, pick out, if they're a fashion influencer, pick out their outfit, you know, get the lighting right and getting the right shot too. So writing the caption, I mean,
we did a quick survey and found that the average kind of time to post a photo from, you know, choosing product, styling, shooting, editing, caption, all that was 5 to 10 hours.
Yeah. Wow. So that's.
Yeah. And you think about Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hour rule, right? And it's like, these people are experts.
Yeah. And with video production, it's even more time intensive, you know, the editing, especially if you're a one person show and you're doing everything by yourself. I mean, it takes a lot of time. You know, they're working, you know.
And why do you think people just assume that it's easy and they're just lounging around taking photos? Is it because of the way they make it look effortless?
Yes. I think that's part of it, is that, you know, these feeds are so glamorized and it just seems easy.
Yeah. And have you talked at all or gotten a sense for, because there is this this idea. Everybody likes the aspirational, right? Yeah. I mean, for a long time, Vogue, right? It's just all editorial. It's like, oh, there is an element of wanting something that is aspirational, right? Does the behind the scenes detract from that at all?
That's a good question.
Because the highlight reel has a place, right? I mean, whether it's sports, whether it's fashion, whether, you know, whatever it is, we like looking at highlight reels, right? Yeah. And we've talked about the mental health issue. So there's a balance there. How do you strike that balance?
Yeah, I think we can kind of appreciate both. I think it's nice to see the behind the scenes because it's a reality check of like this, you know, it's, you know, not everything you see on Instagram is 100% real or as effortless as it looks. I think it's a positive thing overall. And I think it's, especially if you see celebrities and kind of their behind the scenes, it humanizes them a little bit more. And you've seen this kind of trend of people posting two photos on Instagram and it's like Instagram versus reality. And it's the perfect shot they got. And then kind of the blooper. So I think people generally like to see that and like to have this kind of reality check of like, okay, it's not so easy and perfect to
absolutely
do this.
Yeah. So what are some of the preconceived notions that people have about influencers that are right, that are accurate?
I think they definitely do get a lot of perks. You know, they get free hotel stays, they're paid for travel, you know, they get lots of free products, you know, often they have VIP access to events. They get to meet a lot of interesting people. And I think a lot of them really do like having the flexibility of being their own boss and being able to, you know, turn a passion, whether that's for fashion or beauty, you know, into, you know, their own thing and their own career.
Mm-hmm. So now here's the question though, are those perks warranted, right? That's the big thing, right? Because working hard for the perks is one thing, getting them handed to you and not working hard for them is another thing. And, you know, are they deserved?
It's a good question. I mean, I think generally, you know, influencers work their butt off. So,
yeah. And of course you have outliers.
Yes, of course.
Right. You have people who work way too hard. You have people who don't work hard and, you know, and usually at the end of the day, whatever work you put in comes home to roost. But yeah, I think generally you're right. Like it's one of those things where if you work hard, there are reasons why people are spending a lot of money on influencers because it has an impact.
Yeah, you know? I think it's kind of on the brand too to decide. Like if you're giving these free products, are you seeing an ROI on that? Is this actually convincing, you know, consumers to buy this? Is this increasing your brand awareness? I think that's kind of too on the brand. If, you know, if they want to send out a bunch of free products, that's kind of on them, I think.
Yeah, it's funny because we wrote a series of articles about why your influencer marketing isn't working. And a lot of people like to just throw shade at influencers all the time. And there's an article in the Wall Street Journal, you know, with a clickbaity headline. It was a very mediocre article, I'd say, a retread of, some of the complaints about influencers. But the issue for me is, in many cases, why aren't we talking about the brands, right? If you're not getting your ROI on influencer marketing spend, it's not like you can go out and just say, throw money at influencers and expect your product to sell, right? It's like anything. With Facebook advertising or Instagram advertising, it takes months to refine your messaging, your creative, the audience you want to target, the retargeting. People take 6 or 7 times to see something before they buy something. And brands are thinking, well, we'll hand influencer marketing to the youngest person in the office because they're young. They'll understand, you know, how to run an influencer marketing campaign because they know social media and expect it to work. A couple of things wrong with that. First of all, this is more about people management than it actually is about understanding social media. Second of all, you have to look at all the analytics and understand, is this person going to actually reach the people I want them to reach? And then third, you have to understand how to execute, right? There are so many questions that come up here. At the end of the day, it's not a platform. These are people. And so I think you're right. We have to start looking at the brand and saying, okay, this is more of a codified industry now. You should be asking the right questions and running your campaigns a certain way. Because I can't tell you how many times we've heard influencers say, well, they changed the brief at the last minute when I'd already shot the content. You know, it's just, it's crazy.
So, yeah. So I think that in many ways, the influencer marketing industry has become more sophisticated, but I don't think all strategies are sophisticated. And I think it's still such a new space that people are trying to figure out, you know, what works best for my brand. I spoke with a YouTuber the other day and he was like, it is still a wild, wild west. And
100%.
It depends so much on what brand you're working with. So I think people are still trying to figure out what is the best strategy. What are the metrics to look at? You know, there doesn't seem to be a key metric that is, you know, the thing you look for.
But it also changes, right?
Definitely.
And it not only does it change from brand to brand, but it changes changes by product within brands, right? Mm-hmm. Doing swipe ups on Insta stories might work for product X, but it might not for product Y. And so you have to have a sophisticated strategy. There's a reason why people who are really good at Facebook and Instagram marketing, you know, mm-hmm. the paid advertisements that you see come through on these platforms, get paid a lot of money because they drive ROI. The same rigor has to be taken when you think about influencer marketing, because mm-hmm. it's going to become a bigger and bigger part of the budget. You have to approach it with the same professionalism and aggressiveness and focus that you do the other parts of your marketing organization. You wouldn't do an ad buy, you know, on TV or billboards or any without doing the requisite homework. Why are you doing that for influencer marketing? It's not like there's some magic. Like it takes the same amount of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think stories too are a place that some brands are sleeping on, because think, you know, a lot of influencers tell me that they prefer to do, you know, story content in general, but especially for brands, just because it feels much more authentic than this, you know, traditionally posed picture of them, you know, holding, you know, X brand and being like, oh, I just love this brand. So
right.
I think stories is a great opportunity. And there's so many interactive tools, you know, there's polls, there's questions, there's stickers, and I think it's more engaging, and especially now Instagram has opened up its AR platform to creators, so they can create filters, and that's another opportunity for brands to have more of an immersive experience. Snapchat has been doing this for years, and it's proven very effective, where you have this custom filter, and you know it's branded, but if you do it in a way that's engaging and fun for the consumer, they'll interact with it.
Right, absolutely. So let's change gears a little bit. Let's talk about you for a second. What was your favorite story?
I have
the last
two,
year. Okay.
That's okay.
All right,
so.
Love it, yeah. first, before we get into that, yeah. Tell people where they can find you and your stories.
Yeah, so you can find my stories at cnn.com/business, or you can Google my name or find me on social media, and you can click on my bio, and then it has a list of my recent stories.
And then alternatively, they can also find you on Twitter and Instagram, right?
Yes, my handle for both is at kyurieff, K-Y-U-R-I-E-F-F.
All right, so you have two favorite stories.
Okay, two favorite stories. So the first one is I spent a month interviewing transgender YouTube creators. It was ahead of Pride Month in June, and I talked to them about their experiences on YouTube. YouTube has become this amazing resource for the trans community. You know, it's been a place where they can find and share their stories of their gender transitions, their identity struggles, you know, their experiences with surgeries and hormone treatments. And it's been a big source of education and a way for trans people to connect as well.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, creators have sometimes run into issues with some of their trans-related content, such as sex ed videos becoming, you know, limited from making money from ads on YouTube or becoming age-restricted.
Okay.
So many have told me that they're really frustrated with YouTube's lack of transparency around kind of why certain videos are being demonetized. And there's a lot of gray areas in their rules. So, you know, a lot of advertisers don't want to be associated with, you know, sexual content or mature
sure.
content.
Yeah.
But a lot of these videos that trans people are putting out are really, you know, non-graphic sexual ed, which is okay under YouTube's policies. But mm-hmm. it's not totally defined what that means, what that is.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, one sex ed expert was like, you can't talk about sex ed without talking about sex. So,
right, yeah.
So it was really amazing to hear kind of these stories of these really brave people who are sharing really personal and heartbreaking experiences with an audience. And they've built an audience around this and a support system. But then they have to navigate these issues with demonetization. You know, in some cases, some of the videos CNN Business flagged from trans creators were later remonetized by YouTube.
That's nice.
It remains kind of an ongoing
issue. Doing good
issue.
Work out there.
but also, you know, YouTubers and both health experts also stress that, you know, the reason this is so important is that there's a lack of comprehensive sex ed education for trans people, especially, you know, in traditional school settings. So YouTube kind of becomes this safe space for trans people to learn about these topics. And, mm-hmm. you know, creators put, as we've talked about, they put so much time and energy and if they're trying to make a career out of this, they have to monetize that in some way. So I think it can be really challenging for them to navigate these different rules with YouTube.
Yeah, absolutely. Not the first time I've heard that about YouTube. And I think their policy is vague for very specific reasons.
Yeah, and it's not just, you know, the trans community that has, you know, dealt with this too. I mean, people talking about fertility struggles
yeah.
and diseases.
No, but I think that's a very poignant example.
Definitely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
And then the other one is just, I thought was really fun. So I profiled a couple that has 7 Instagram famous pets.
7?
Yes. Oh. They are the owners of Nala Cat, who is the most followed cat on Instagram.
Oh, wow.
So while she's pretty well known, I don't think everyone realizes that her owners run this household with all these famous pets. So I met them at VidCon. So I got to interview a cat, which was a first for me.
Yeah. She have a lot to say?
She wouldn't answer any of my questions.
Wow, she's cold, huh?
So I got to chat with them kind of a little bit, what that's like, some of the challenges. They said that they are just working all the time. They have no time.
7 accounts. I can't imagine.
Yeah. And how they monetize. They also, which I thought was very fitting for 2019, the whole family, including the owners, has a CBD sponsored content.
Duh. Yeah. So, no, of course.
So that was just a fun story to hear, you know, and of course Nala had met Grumpy Cat and they had collaborated on things. So it was just a very fun story of how, you know, they've been able to you know, quit their jobs and just run this business. So.
That's really cool. So what about your most alarming story from the past year?
So
the darker side, perhaps.
Yeah. So I think one of the most alarming was I did a story on vaccine misinformation on Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
So at the time, it had been about 2 months since Instagram's parent company, Facebook, had pledged to fight vaccine misinformation on its platforms. We were also in the midst of a measles outbreak in New York City. So despite kind of Facebook's pledge and efforts, you know, I found that just by searching for the word vaccines on Instagram, many of the top results were, you know, anti-vax hashtags and anti-vax content. Instagram had blocked, you know, the hashtag like vaccines cause AIDS, which, you know, is a debunked claim by the World Health Organization. But hashtags like vaccines kill were not blocked and were, you know, rife with misinformation. You know, more than half the top posts were anti-vax content. So I wrote a story about it. And then a day later, you know, Instagram decided to block the vaccines kill hashtag. So that was
Are you going to take credit for that?
I am going to take credit.
Awesome.
For that.
That's great.
So that was a step in the right direction, but it just kind of underscores how platforms like Facebook and Instagram have become this place where misinformation can rapidly spread. And in the case of vaccines, you know, it has real world consequences.
Serious implications. Yeah. And they're not the only platforms. I mean, look at Google and their search results, right? Because at the end of the day, it's an algorithm. And if we had a skincare expert on a podcast talking about the Kylie Lip Challenge. I don't know if you remember that, but people were effectively suctioning their lips inside of glasses or cups, which is extremely dangerous because Kylie for a long time didn't say that she was using fillers and people were having serious issues with their lips because of that. And we got into a discussion about even Googling for certain things. You'll find the right answer or the medically correct answer on page 3. Nobody's going to go to page 3. They're going to look at the first 5, do a rough average and say, okay, that's the right answer. Mm-hmm. And it is a big problem. And it's also an issue when you get influencers who aren't experts and they're relying on Google and they're, you know, so having kind of a layer of filtering, and then there's obviously the real fake news and the misinformation that is spread, right?
Yeah. Yeah, YouTube has kind of taken the approach of putting the top results. So when we looked at vaccine misinformation on YouTube, and really the top results on the first page were all really either news reports or, you know, trusted organizations like the World Health Organization. So in certain cases, YouTube has done a pretty good job of kind of elevating the authoritative voices.
Sure, but that's hard because you have to go case by case and it's manual. It's no longer automated, right? Because so you attack a specific issue like vaccination, you know, misinformation, and you have to do that manually with real people, butts in seats. It's not an algorithm can take care of it. And maybe over time you can, but with these hot button topics, a lot of damage has already been done before you have that intervention. Yeah.
Yeah. These platforms have gotten so big too that they have a really difficult job policing this content.
I don't think people understand how big and how much data is floating around and how difficult it is. People complain about the algorithm on Instagram. And I said this earlier, nobody knows how the algorithm on Instagram actually works because of how it's built, right? There are a number of engineers working on it, all with different responsibilities. There are a bunch of different levers pulled. And then you think about Google, which is indexing the internet. You think about YouTube, which is the second biggest search engine in the world. You think about all these Facebook with 2 billion people on it. It takes a lot of effort and, you know, hats off to these folks who've built these amazing platforms and keep them running and bring a lot of value. There are going to be some hiccups along the way. And it's good that they're taking proactive steps to you know, do things about mental health, to do things about misinformation. But it's hard. It's a big, big,
it's a big job.
Yeah, and a big responsibility too. So what are you looking forward to writing about in 2020? Are there a couple things on your radar that you're pumped about?
Yeah, I want to do more coverage of TikTok. I think it's a platform that, you know, a lot of older people are trying to figure out still. You know, it's been the first Chinese-backed social media app that has gained traction in the U.S. Historically, you know, Weibo and all these other apps have been really popular within China, but they just haven't resonated in the U.S. So at the same time, you know, we're seeing U.S. government scrutiny over the company, its privacy terms, you know, is data being stored in Chinese servers? So it'll be interesting to see kind of how it plays out. The majority of Americans, according to a Pew study, were not able to identify that Facebook owns Instagram and WhatsApp. So I think a lot of, you know, parents out there may not realize that TikTok is by a Chinese-backed company. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And then also just this whole new generation of TikTok stars, you know, it reminds me of Vine. And I'm curious to see if they stay on TikTok, if they move to other platforms, and kind of the other weird trends that kind of emerge from TikTok, and also how brands lean into that too. Because monetization is still pretty early on TikTok, but, you know, I see brands kind of starting to think about what their TikTok strategy can be, what makes sense for them, you know, what can add value.
It's fascinating. And it's interesting to think about it in the context of this is the first social platform that's taken off in the U.S. that is actually Chinese-based.
And TikTok had this really smart strategy of flooding their competitors with TikTok ads. So they had ads on Snapchat, they had ads on Instagram, and it really pushed people to download the app and just create brand awareness.
But they had
the money to do that.
Right, but they also allow you to publish all of your videos to all the other platforms mm-hmm. as well, which, you know, Instagram doesn't do necessarily. They allow
Snapchat,
you to post to Facebook.
Yeah. It hasn't done that either.
Right. And so you go to, you see on Instagram a video of somebody doing a funky, you know, TikTok type dance, and you see it's branded TikTok. You're like, oh, I'm going to head over there and see what's happening over there. It's a very different strategy.
Yeah.
And they are definitely taking the world by storm.
Yeah. I also did a story this summer on influencers emerging on LinkedIn. So I'm kind of curious to see, you know, if we see more of that next year. In the past 2 years, LinkedIn has added original video and live streaming. And there's been kind of a whole new group of influencers that have emerged, and they see, you know, a very different platform than other social media. You know, it's obviously lends itself to more professional and job related content. But also it's a lot less crowded than other networks. So some people have been able to really build a name for themselves and, you know, quit their jobs and be a LinkedIn influencer. So it's definitely a place I'm watching too.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be fun. Well, Kai, thanks so much for joining us today on Influencer Business.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome conversation with Kaya. If you're not already doing so, make sure you check her out on Instagram and Twitter. Her handle is kyuriev. Or head over to CNN Business and check out her profile with all of her articles. She's got some amazing content there. I want to talk about a few quick things that came up during our conversation that I thought were quite interesting and very applicable to the folks listening to this podcast. The first thing that I thought was fascinating is that she writes with her grandmother in mind. She writes for her grandmother. And the way she thinks about it is she tries to make sure that somebody, when she's approaching a topic, somebody who's been following along is not going to be bored, but somebody who has absolutely no background in the topic and is just joining the conversation for the first time will also feel like she's not moving too fast. And so I think this is really important for influencers who perhaps sometimes just get too into talking to the existing audience that they've had for a long time. Make room for new followers. Make sure that you're creating some content that is evergreen. Whoever shows up will kind of understand in context. Of course, you're going to have inside jokes. You're going to have long-running jokes, whatever it might be. But also make sure you're making room for the new followers, making room for the new faces. I think that's incredibly important and a very, very tough line to straddle. The second thing I wanted to talk about was how she, in this world where we live 140 characters, or I guess it's now 280 characters at a time, is able to get people to read long-form content. And she says, have a good hook, but not be too clickbaity. Bring them in, get them excited, and allow them to read the rest of the content. I think this is also very applicable to influencers as well, because it's tough, right? You need to get attention. You want to get attention. You want to get people interested. You want to get them excited about the content that you're creating, but you don't want to be spammy. You don't want to be clickbaity. So think about this in the context of what you're doing with your content. Get the hook, get them in, and then fill out with substance. I think that's really incredibly important. And then the final thing I want to talk about is just a general takeaway from the conversation. These platforms are evolving. They're still so young. We think about them as if they've been around for a long time. But really, I mean, Facebook has only been around for a few years. Snapchat, still new. TikTok, very new. Twitter, also very new. You know, in the context of our lifetime, they've only been around since 2005, 2006. That's kind of when MySpace was first on the scene and Facebook was coming out. And so they're still evolving. And that means you're going to have to evolve too, because you have to evolve in order to continue to grow your business. You have to evolve in order to stay relevant on these platforms. So don't sleep on new features like Stories or Instagram TV. Think about what you can do to make yourself stand out, because and don't look at change as a bad thing. Look at it as an opportunity, because social media platforms came out, you have harnessed them, you've been able to grow on them. That was an opportunity. That change was an opportunity. Now, just because these platforms are evolving doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It just means it's another opportunity for you to stand out. If you look at it in that positive light as an opportunity, it can be really invigorating. So take an opportunity now heading into the new year to do that and see how you can evolve your content and grow with these platforms as they evolve. And as always, for all of this and a whole lot more, head over to trovebusiness.com, where we have everything you could ever want to help you run your business more efficiently. And I just wanted to take a quick moment here and thank everybody for listening. This is going to be the final episode of 2019. It's been incredible so far. Amazing interviews, amazing feedback. Really appreciate you tuning in, whether this was your first episode or you've listened to every single one. We've got a lot of new exciting things coming up, especially the first series of episodes in 2020. So stay tuned for that. And please enjoy the rest of the year, and looking forward to seeing more of you in 2020. And with that, I'm your host, Rich Goodlari. Thanks for being with us here this week, and we'll see you next time.